I'd like to talk about Woodworks Press. You make books the old-fashioned way. What you know? You said you tried to several times to try and quit writing poetry. Now you're not only writing it, but you're publishing it as well.
Right. And there's a kind of stubborn, irreducible quality to what I'm doing, because a lot of the arts have fallen on evil times in recent years. It's fighting for the last dollar down at the end of the table, where they never pass the meatballs anyway, and all they pass is the
brown blizzard.
Right. So you and if you reach for the last potato, you might get a fork in the back of your hand. So we Woodworks. I've got a bunch of old, used, dinged up lead type in the basement of my house, and I've got a couple of presses, and they're all turn of the 19th, you know, one press is in 1874, and another press is a 1903, and another press is an 1897, and I've got these old pieces of iron, and I just do it myself. And if I can scare up the money for the paper, usually I just go right ahead and do it. And I have several projects I'm going to be doing this winter, and if some foundation, I don't ask for foundation support, because if some foundation said no, I would have to find a way to do it anyhow. So this way, I am. And there are a bunch of things about this. One of them is that a handmade object, like one of these books, does in some way compliment the writer. It says, this is worth attending to, this is worth holding on to, this is a keeper. If I can do it right, that's what I intend, is that people will pick it up and say, my, well, I want one of these, you know. And I do the wood carvings on the covers and on the title pages and stuff, just to get people into the work. And if I can get them there, then they'll want it.
And at Bumbershoot each year, you bring a small press to allow folks to make their own postcard.
Right.
So they
can gave away 1,200 postcards in 4 days.
Is that right? This most recent Bumbershoot.
Right. Yeah. Right. Maybe 1,500 postcards. A lot of them.
It's a way to convey to people what you do through Woodworks, very simply. I mean, that's what they mean. They're pulling the crank, and you know, every now and then you hear the cha-ching kind of sound,
right,
and another postcard goes
out. And they, yeah, and they get it, and they get to feel what it's like, that it doesn't, there's nothing standing between them and the work. It's experience is, and of course what it does is it calls up good and bad memories for older people, and it is a wonderment and something that some young people aspire to. I mean, if I had a room full of those little presses, I could have sold them at Bumbershoot every year. I have half a dozen people who say, "Where can I get one just like this?" but
again, it's something that harkens back to a slower time.
Right.
This is
an effortful time. Well, I have this idea about this idea about appropriate technology, that we live in a world that where we can cut across in a way cut across time. I mean, you could go out and ride a horse, and you could also drive 100 miles an hour in your car, and you can also get in an airplane. And one of the interesting things about our history as a species is that we have tended to keep some technologies with us as we go. Notice that sailing is still done. It's bigger than it ever was. And there are technical advances in sailing that make it better than it ever was as well. It's like we haven't completely turned loose of the wind, in part because we may need it. Right? We may run out of gas. We might sputter to a halt and may have to cross oceans again the old way. And might as well, you know, have our hand on that technology. I think it was Barry Commoner who had, in an essay in The New Yorker, convinced me about this idea of appropriate technology, that you can print books in a lot of different ways to bring it back to the, but letterpress is the, it isn't the slowest and most effortful. You could hand copy a book. If you had beautiful penmanship, you could do that. But of course, there's no multiplication of your effort at all. You're back there with Chaucer and his 6-foot shelf of books.
You're not scratching out when you make a mistake and just going on.
No, right, no, right. No. And you're not, and all of that, all of the problems that was that the world of scribes had to go with it. I mean, I love the whole business of letterpress, because our current use of print still depends on it. What we think of as a beautiful typeface has been honed by 500 years of using typefaces. We've tried lots of different things in 500 years, and it's very interesting that if you just hand any person on the street half a dozen typefaces have the same words printed in 5 or 6 different ways, they will invariably pick one of those typefaces that the Italians and the French and the Dutch settled upon in the first 50 years after Gutenberg. It's amazing. It's just amazing.
And there's something about it that suggests that this it was a time when our technology had not outstripped our ceremonial gratitude. So there wasn't that disconnect there. You know, John Ashbery wrote a blurb for the book, says, "Your poems bear witness to an agrarian vision that is slowly becoming history." Can you tell us about your connection to Ashbery and perhaps read something that highlights that lost vision? How'd you get a blurb from him? Part of the question.
I got, he likes my work. I printed a poem of his as a broadside and did a woodcut with it. And
now how does one go about getting permission? You go through the channels, perhaps Open Books is a connection, because I know you did a reading there a few years ago.
But Ashbery came to Seattle to do a reading, and I did a broadside with the Counterbalance Poetry Series, and they got me permission to pick any poem of John Ashbery's. And so I picked that one, and away we went. But I knew also that he was raised on a farm. I mean, you'd think of him as the sophisticated urban writer, but in fact, a lot of his imagery comes from close observation of the growing world and the world of plants and animals that is the farm.
There's a poem called Pioneers in the book that in one way sort of illustrates what he's talking about there. That's on page 67.
Yeah.
Talking with Paul Hunter, poet, publisher. His newest connection is entitled Breaking Ground.
Pioneers. Wherever they move, they leave tracks, break trails, roll out roads. Where they stop a few hours, they make shelter, start fire, kill to feed their hunger. Where they stay a while, they cut down trees, dam water, dig holes, put up walls, close doors, scatter their seed, and wander. Burning up the night, soon they cut down the dark and set it against itself. They cage animals, keep pets, mark down what is theirs as well as what is not. Escaping in time these rough enclosures, their young soon scale whatever is on high, swing out and splash their paint like blood, enter caves and feel their way cleared to the bottom. Eventually, they plant flowers to hide their shame, raise up trees, cut holes in walls to look away, hang mirrors, bury the dead that lie around, discourage newcomers by erecting signs that point everywhere at once, obscuring the devious ways they come and go. You think the final end of the Santa Fe Trail is getting lost in the maze of Los Angeles. In some ways, the final end of the Oregon Trail, though, you can still not get lost and kind of find your way to the Willamette River in the middle of Oregon. It's an odd thing that people came to the New World thinking there was this free land. They didn't come for a handout. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I have the feeling that these agrarian feelings are going to in some way be a salvation for us, because they will ask us to slow down, to see what we can plant in our yard and in our heart, and not be so greedy, not be so desirous of just getting a quick fix, a quick cure to anything.
You, in the author notes, refer to a virus that's eating the planet. This is what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, farmers are not immune from it either. In some ways, I got my value system from my mother's father, who was my grandfather was a school teacher. He taught a one-room schoolhouse, and he also had a general store, and he also had a funeral parlor and a wagon-making business and a lunch counter and the first gas pump in this little area of southern Indiana, Dover, Indiana. And he had his finger on everything. And he didn't really care about making a lot of money. I mean, he came through the Depression. Probably everybody at that end of the county owed him money, and it didn't matter. You know, he was fine.
Sounds a lot like you. Poet, you know, publisher. You fixed the roof of your house a couple of years ago, growing stuff in the backyard.
Yeah.
There's a poem entitled Sorry in the book. It's a tribute to an Edward Holtz who didn't like kids messing with his mailbox. I remember this one at Red Sky and an interesting sort of shift that it makes. Page 23, Sorry, from the collection Breaking Ground, new poems by Paul Hunter, who's our guest today.